This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. When I walked into the building today, I got a greeting that is pretty familiar to most of you, I'm sure. Happy Friday! Yes, in American culture, Friday is seen as the blessed end to a long week of work. What that week is like has changed a lot over time. Workers who do work are working long days, and as we've discussed on the program recently, they're not taking very much vacation time. Many others are still looking for work. They're unemployed or underemployed, or they're stringing together two or three jobs in a way that many of our parents and grandparents just wouldn't recognize as work. Today, Where We Live, Working Today, we'll talk about breaking cycles of unemployment and about how work has changed over the decades. We're doing this as Connecticut Humanities continues their year-long Connecticut at Work program. You can find more at cthumanities.org. And we want you to join the conversation. How is the work your parents did different from the work you're doing now? How has work changed during your working life? Give us a call, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You can always comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Let's start our conversation with a bit of history, though. The textile industry in America dates back to the late 1700s here in New England, and Connecticut, with its many rivers used to power the mills, was a major hub of production for more than 100 years. But that all changed around the Great Depression, and now the industry in Connecticut is all but extinct. Let me bring in Jamie Eves, who's executive director of the Wyndham Textile and History Museum in Willimantic, also adjunct faculty at Eastern Connecticut State University. Jamie Eves, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
I'm wondering if you can just give us a little bit of the history of the textile industry in Connecticut. When exactly did it start, and when did it start to decline?
It started, as you said, during the last decade of the 1700s. The first textile factory in the United States was in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, just across the border. That's Slater's famous mill that opened in 1793. And so it's expanding really within a few years into Connecticut. The first thing were really the small little custom mills with carding machines. But it starts to turn into real factories in the 1820s. When what we would recognize as those big stone and brick buildings that line our rivers, those water-powered factories were built in various gorges, mostly in eastern and central Connecticut.
How big was the industry at its height in the 1800s?
Well, the height would have been the end of the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, and in eastern Connecticut, it was the major industrial employer. One of the things that I've done at the museum is we got a map and we went through census records and we put stickers of various sizes, little circles for different mills. And pretty much eastern and central Connecticut were just plastered with the stickers for the textile industry. So it was the major industrial employer in our region.
So what started to happen to take those jobs away to force the textile industry from being the big king it was in Connecticut in that those few decades to something that is all but non-existent now?
It was a combination of several different factors that occurred. To understand the decline, first of all, we'd need to understand the rise. And it would seem to be a mystery why anyone would locate a textile industry based on cotton, which was the major product that they used for thread and cloth, here in New England, where we don't grow cotton. But what New England had that other parts of the United States did not have was abundant water power located very near seaports. Because there's no continental shelf in New England. The glaciers took care of that long, long ago. The waterfalls are located only a few miles inland from ports. So in Willimantic, where we have our museum, Willimantic was a major center of thread production in Connecticut, and it's located only a few miles away from the port of Norwich. So Norwich, New London, Providence, Hartford, Portland, and places like that in Connecticut became the major ports that then connected up to the factories that were only a few miles inland. The water power is what made it go, and water power was the chief source of energy until after the Civil War, and then new sources of energy started to be developed. And so one of the things that happens is they began to put in steam power to operate the machines, and train loads of coal come from Pennsylvania and West Virginia and other parts of Appalachia to New England to provide the energy sources for the mills. And they begin to put in electric lights, not relying just on daylight as they had before. You couldn't dare put an open flame in a cotton mill. It would cause fires. There was so much dust and lint in the air that was so flammable. So when we get to really the period of the 1870s is when steam power comes in. The 1880s is electric lights. We tell the story here in Willimantic that the first modern factory in the entire world was in Willimantic. It was a one-story building spread way out because it could have electric lights. You didn't need to have huge windows and a narrow floor space so that the light would penetrate. It was all on steam power. It wasn't water-powered, this building, which they built it, you know, around 1880. It was up away from the river. And when it was built, people came by train from all over New England to see this structure. It was considered marvelous and wonderful that such a huge structure could be lit entirely with electric lights. And what nobody realized is they had just signed the death warrant of the New England textile industry, that now that you no longer need water power, you can relocate those mills. You can put them in the south, which is near the cotton fields, which is near the coal fields. It doesn't have to be up here. So technology is one thing. A second is that labor became much cheaper in other places in the years after the Civil War, and particularly, again, the U.S. South. One of the things that that happened is that in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, there's an agricultural crisis in Appalachia in the South. The old mountain farms that had been farmed too long, the soil was losing its fertility, the topsoil was washing away, having been overplowed for years. Poverty became terrible in Appalachia in the years after the Civil War, and there's an exodus of people out of Appalachia looking for work. And they would work cheap. And so they move on down into new textile factories in the South, started with Northern Capital. It's often the New England companies actually are building branch plants down there. But it's a cheaper labor. There is a myth that I encounter at the museum all the time. Visitors say, oh, it must be that the textile industry left New England in the 1960s, and it must be because of powerful labor unions and environmental protection laws and workplace safety laws. And that's just not historically correct. It's long before that. Textile unions in the United States were very weak in the 19th and even early 20th centuries. Not until really after 1937 do textile unions become very strong in the United States. And really, there's not a lot of workplace safety laws during those early years either.
But it really was about the raw economics of all of this, which I think you've explained right. Very well, and makes so much sense that indeed, by moving off of the water power, we signed our own death warrant of the textile industry here. Jamie Eaves is executive director of the Wyndham Textile and History Museum in Willimantic. We're going to move the conversation ahead in just a moment, but Jamie, just a quick step back. So that we don't over-romanticize these times, I guess I'm wondering if you can explain during the height of textile production driven by rivers in the late part of the 1900s, say, up into the 20th century. I mean, what was life like in these mills? You call them crowded, lots of dust in the air, working during long daylight hours. Explain what life was like for these workers.
Well, it was horrible for the most part. It was really terrible. You're right. We don't want to over-romanticize it. When I've done oral histories with former textile workers, they certainly don't over-romanticize the work. People who were in management remember it fondly. People who were the scientists and the technicians remember it fondly. But when I talk to the people who worked on the floor, usually their greatest desire was that their kids go to high school and get a better job and not have to work in the mills.
And not work in the mills. And, you know, back where I grew up, it was to try to get out of the steel mills and lots of other places. You were trying to find a way to get your kids out of that work. Now, recently, WNPR reporter Jay Holt spoke with the CEO, Jacob Harrison, of American Woolen. This CEO is bringing some textile industry back to Connecticut at a plant in Stafford Springs that's been closed. He's told us that he's confident the business can be revived. Let's listen to a little bit of that interview.
The idea that American Woolen's approach on the industry is a different approach. We want to stress the manufacturing, the various elements, and again, we want Stafford to become a destination for people who think that the textile industry in America can come back.
I want to get Jamie Eaves' take on that in just a moment, but I want to bring in Joe Carbone, who's CEO of The Workplace in Bridgeport. He's someone who's thought a lot about work life in Connecticut, and I want to ask you, Joe, first of all, welcome to the program, and I'd like to ask you what you think about the possibility of textile manufacturing coming back to the state of Connecticut, even in the small way that the folks at American Woolen are trying to do.
Well, I guess I hadn't thought of it really until I just heard it now. I wasn't aware of the investment there in Stafford Springs. But I think, as the previous speaker had mentioned, that most of us have pretty much been dismissive of the possibility of something like a textile business finding a new home in Connecticut or being able to be profitable in our state. I wish it well, but I think it would have an uphill battle. And I think, again, the issue would be the economics of it. That's been our problem with a lot of different products, is that it's so important that you, in order to be competitive, that you deal with the issue of cost. And Connecticut is a great state, and we have probably the best prepared workforce in the entire nation. But we are not cheap to operate. Everything from energy to building to land to cost for labor and for lots of other things is very, very expensive. So in many cases, we have transitioned ourselves to from being a manufacturing state, as we were back in the periods that were mentioned, to what we are today, which is basically a service state. It would be nice to see that happen again in Connecticut, but you know, offhand, without giving it much thought or seeing many numbers, I would say that in order to be competitive, it would be very, very difficult.
Jamie Eaves, you have taken a look at the long history of textile production. What do you think about the idea of some textile manufacturing remaining in the state?
I was aware that they were going to be coming back and attempting to manufacture woolens again in Stafford. I think it's certainly possible, and there are other entrepreneurs that are thinking about it. But I think what we have to understand is it's not going to be the way that it was, that this is a very different kind of industry that we're talking about. Most of the entrepreneurs that want to bring textile manufacturing back to the United States as a whole, they want to, you know, they sent it to China, and now there's some of the people are trying to bring it back. They're talking really in terms of factories that are highly mechanized, with very small workforces. In some places, we're even talking about what are sometimes called dark factories, because there'll be an entire room where there are no people in there. There's just machines, and so you don't need to turn on the lights and don't need to have any heat on. At its height, the American Thread Company, which was the largest thread company in North America, is located in Willimantic. At its height, it had 3,500 workers. Other textile factories that did weaving had even more. We're not going to see those numbers again. So if we're thinking about trying to recreate massive numbers of jobs, I think that's really highly unlikely, because it's not going to be the same thing. The textile industry globally relies on cheap labor, and I don't think that's what Connecticut is looking for.
Jamie Eaves is executive director of the Wyndham Textile and History Museum in Willimantic. Thank you for this really interesting historical tour of this very important industry in the state, Jamie. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
We're taking a look at Connecticut work life here in the state, and you can join us at 860-275-7266 as we get ready for a long Labor Day weekend. We just heard from Joe Carbone, CEO of The Workplace in Bridgeport. He's in our New Haven studios, along with Amy Trout, curator at the Connecticut River Museum. Before our break, I want to welcome in Amy Trout and just talk about something that, of course, coincided with what Jamie Eaves just talked about. The end of the textile industry in Connecticut was around the time of the Great Depression. Maybe you can give us a little bit of a history on the effect of the Great Depression here in Connecticut and the way it changed the way people work in our state.
Sure. As Jamie was saying, that Connecticut was a manufacturing state. So when the Great Depression hit, you had closures and cutbacks in the workforce, which led to difficulties for families to find jobs. And here in New Haven, you might have, I did a lot of research in New Haven while I was at the New Haven Museum, and you had bank failures. You had really an overwhelming response for private charities and religious organizations, people like that, who were trying to pick up and become the safety net, and it was pretty overwhelming for them.
So as you look through the changes in the way Connecticut was affected by the Great Depression, what are the really big impacts you think this time period had on the way Connecticut kind of traversed and built its way up as a workforce over the rest of the 20th century after that period?
Well, Connecticut was interesting because it did have both large manufacturing in its cities, and it had still had an agricultural base too. So you had both rural and urban problems. And Connecticut was affected because you had in the 1930s, a lot of that manufacturing plants were kind of in a decaying state. They were not kept up and modernized. So that you had kind of an urban decay going on, and you had flight from the rural base as well. So you kind of had, you know, trouble on both fronts. And it was difficult for someone like the governor at the time, who was Wilbur Cross, to handle both of those areas of difficulty. And he was never a giant New Dealer. So he had to sort of tread this uncomfortable position of looking at both conservative agricultural areas and urban areas that perhaps were more eager for a federal impulse.
And I guess I'm wondering if you can see if there were winners and losers out of all this. Obviously, we talk about those mill towns, the ones that lost so many jobs as manufacturing changed, as jobs fled to the South. Were there other parts of the state, cities or rural areas, that were hit especially hard by the Depression?
Well, I think the worst hit were obviously the manufacturing centers, places where plants were closing. In New Haven, there were, Winchester and other large manufacturing concerns were really cutting back on the workforce. New Haven was a little luckier in the sense that it had Yale University, which had an alumni fund base that was building. So the trades were still active here. But in other parts of the country, particularly the area where Jamie was referring to, the textile industries, there were labor unrests. So anywhere you had manufacturing, that they were the hardest hit.
We're talking today about work life in Connecticut, how it's changed over the decades. Amy Trout is curator of the Connecticut River Museum. Joe Carbone is CEO of The Workplace in Bridgeport. When we come back, we're going to take some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. As we get ready for this Labor Day weekend, we would like to hear from you about how work life has changed. How is the work your parents did different from the work you're doing now? Does any of this history about some of the manufacturing jobs in Connecticut leaving, how does any of this affect you and your family? We want to hear from you. 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Hope you can join us this evening as we do a live recording of our show at Hartford Prince in downtown Hartford on Pratt Street. We will feature a panel of artists, musicians, and educators for a discussion about the role and importance of arts and arts education in the lives of our kids. There'll be music by Ellison Jackson, the great band from the southern part of the state. They're coming up to Hartford, and I hope you can too. The event begins at around 6 o'clock and is free and open to the public, and we hope to see you there. Today we're talking about work life in Connecticut. There's a year-long project from Connecticut Humanities, which you can find out more about at cthumanities.org. It's called Connecticut at Work. Some of the folks who have been involved in that are Amy Trout, who's curator of the Connecticut River Museum, and Joe Carbone, CEO of The Workplace in Bridgeport. In just a moment, we'll take some of your phone calls at 860-275-7266 about how you feel working life has changed over the course of your career. How are the jobs that you're doing right now different than the jobs your parents were doing? We'd also like to hear your stories. If you're looking for work, you feel like you're underemployed right now. You know, Joe Carbone, that's the next thing I want to talk about is as we get to the future of work in Connecticut. I guess we should probably talk a little bit about the present right now. You hear the candidates for governor talking about jobs and trying to get more employment for people here in Connecticut. I guess I'm wondering how you feel our employment situation in the state is right now.
Well, I think that it's getting better for sure. I mean, we've had job growth now for several months continually. But I think we're continuing to go through a period of change. And it's largely the result of basically the Great Recession that we just went through. This one was structural. This was not a cyclical kind of recession like we've had. Most of them have been since World War II. And it's really a moment that you don't just look at the industries in Connecticut and how the economy has changed in that way. It's really the effect that it has on the human capital side of employment. No matter what you do, if you're a professional or if you're an hourly worker or whatever it might be, you need to look at how what you do affects your future from the standpoint of these kinds of changes. I mean, just as an example here, I think the whole nature of human capital is such that even companies or employers of any types that are having growth post-recession, turning to human capital to satisfy the need, to respond to that growth is not the first alternative as it's been since World War II. It's the last. You now have technology and you have a lot of other factors that often you can use to substitute for human capital. So I think the intensity of kind of the need to show what you can bring to the employer, what you can do that's kind of an expertise or something that you can add value to the employer is more critical today than ever before. That's a very, very profound change. That's the result of a structural change that we have gone through. You know, we see this surge of part-time employment. We see a surge of using staffing agencies. There's no other way to look at that except to kind of recognize and accept that there's a different value placed on really human capital in terms of how businesses or how employers of any type reach a point where they can be successful. Mm. We need to adjust to that. We may not like it, but we cannot reverse this. And so actually complaining about it is not the way to do it. It needs to be embraced.
I wonder, though, if there's some sort of a – if there's a gap that can be filled by companies, by industry sectors, by someone looking at a way to do business in a new way to be competitive that actually changes a little bit of that paradigm you just laid out, Joe, that maybe puts a little bit more emphasis on the human capital the way it used to be. Is there something in there for whether it's a manufacturing company or a service company to really look at work and workers in a different way than it seems like the employment sector is right now?
Well, actually, I mean, I think they are. I think they're looking at one of the reasons why they're turning to staffing agencies so much is that they're looking at having your particular expertise when they need it for as long as they need it and be able to avoid any kind of liability once they don't need it anymore. I mean, that's a reality of our times. And I think the wiser you are, the more you have to recognize it and get yourself prepared for that. It's almost like you need to be thinking of yourself as an individual contractor, that you're not part of something larger, one of 3,000 employees in a factory or something, but it's you. And you have to look at your future in that respect.
Let's go to a phone call. Deirdre is calling from Cornwall. Hello there. You're on Where We Live.
Hi, this is Deirdre.
Hi there. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Well, my main concern has a lot to do with what this gentleman is saying. I'm worried for my kids who are 17 and 19, and there's no added value they can say they have already for any entry-level work, particularly in my area, which is quite rural. And they'll have to leave home, and they'll have to go elsewhere, and they can't probably stay in Connecticut until they're well established. And then maybe they can come back.
Do you think, Deirdre, that your kids, whether it's through school or their expectations, maybe the area they live, they're just not prepared for this work environment that Joe Carbone is describing?
My kids have had a really great education. If anything, their expectations are quite high for what they will do. And so the entry-level options for them here, they're just not here. Until they're done with college and grad school, maybe they can think of coming back. But for a young person starting out, there's, at least in the northwest corner, nothing.
Deirdre, thank you so much for your phone call. It adds a lot to our conversation. And Joe, this is fascinating because we hear, whether it's President Obama saying, I want every single American child to go to college, or just the expectations that we have in the high school of our kids to do certain things. Deirdre's talking about kids who get a good education, who have very high expectations of what work life can mean to them, and then nothing that's out there kind of aligns with those very expectations. That seems like a big problem to me.
Well, it is. I mean, we try to encourage our kids to go to college and do the right thing, and we often don't tell them that, you know, look at the economy, look at the trends, look at what's a hot job, and maybe you get your education in that field. We don't do that. I didn't do that with my kids, and I'm not necessarily really saying that it's the right thing to do, but a lot of kids get a general education degree in something that's got some opportunity, but not a great deal. They come into the market, and it just isn't there, and unless you're willing really to move and go somewhere where it is, that you're going to have great, great difficulty. So I think it's a case of really working with your kids as early as you can and try to get them to think of themselves that I need to produce something that really will make me an expert in something, something that I can add value to. Adding value is critically important. That's the new term. You know, lifelong learning will always be, I think, you know, the underpinning to your pathway into the future. But thinking of yourself as a figure which you can add value to whatever employer that you might work for is now just as critical as it's ever been.
If you have stories like Deirdre's to add to our conversation, 860-275-7266, as we talk now about the present and maybe future of work life in Connecticut. Joe Carbone joins us from our New Haven studios. He's CEO and president of The Workplace in Bridgeport. Amy Trout is with us from New Haven as well. She's curator at the Connecticut River Museum. And we talked a bit before the break, Amy, with you about the history that you've dug into around the Great Depression. You know, I think we always think of everything as brand new. Like, this is the very first time we've been in a cycle like this in American history. And sure, there are a lot of different things about our economy that we can point to that might make it seem that way. But I wonder if you can draw any parallels or anything from your historical research about the Great Depression, about what we might learn about how to come out of this great recession that we have right now.
I think the biggest thing I can address about the 1930s and the Great Depression at that time is that there wasn't the initiatives both in the private sector and in the public sector, municipalities or federal government, that was offering people an option. And it wasn't until the New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt's program to get the country back to work when he first became elected, that offered these new ideas, new initiatives, and that was that the federal government was going to help you. In Connecticut, like the rest of the country, prior to 1933, you had to rely on families, asking your relatives, did they know where there was a job? You had to rely on private charities, and you had to rely on churches, religious groups, to help anybody who was out of work, and where was the opportunity going to come? There wasn't the opportunities. I mean, we know the classic stories of people moving west, you know, the migrant workers and such, during the Great Depression to try to find work. I mean, it was desperation. So it was bleak. And then came along these revolutionary ideas that the federal government was going to actually help put people back to work. And they did it by looking at the different workforces in the country, blue collar and then white collar. And they were trying to actually mold these jobs, these opportunities, these programs to fit different people out of work. And that was pretty new and revolutionary at the time.
Well, and I'm wondering, you know, as we think back to this history, Joe Carbone, so right now, we've got seemingly a workforce that's not entirely aligned with what needs to be done. There's companies that are seeking something much different from workers, at least what workers want. Workers are looking for full-time employment coming out of college where they get paid a certain amount of money, and they're having to chase around two or three jobs as private contractors. Is it time to think about, maybe not, you know, in an FDR standpoint, but some sort of a new deal where the government actually says, you know, we need to step in somehow to make sure that people get the kind of work that's going to help America move forward, that's going to help people get the jobs that they really need?
I'm not sure that really that it's a case in which government needs to do that. You know, look at what's occurred here. As a result of this recession, I mean, there have been millions of people that are part of this group that we call the long-term unemployed. And this has been primarily my work for now 4 years. It started out where you had just a few thousand people in this category, but this group of people, it's increasing every single month. Now, this recession officially ended more than 5 years ago. And if we're waiting for a change to say, you know, the halcyon days of yours are back, don't hold your breath on that. This recession is over. What we have is what we're going to have. And what we're going to have is where the pendulum of advantage has made a huge shift from the employee to the employer. There is greater choice out there. I mean, it's not unusual for employers to have 300 applicants in one day for every job. They can't possibly sort through them and analyze them, so that a common practice is you take various things that you think will separate the pack, be they fair or not, this happens. If you're long-term unemployed, and let's say in a state like Connecticut, you know, this was a mean recession, and it literally plucked people out of all professions, as professional as you might have been, or if you worked in a low-wage job, and you're out of work for a long time. In Connecticut, we gave benefits for 99 weeks of unemployment. Once you cross that threshold of 1 year of unemployment, you have lost consideration, your ability to be considered for future employment. It has nothing to do with whether or not you have skills. So it's nothing to do with the skill gap or anything of that sort. It has to do with a structural change that occurred that makes you less valuable in terms of being considered, because there's a bounty of other talent and you're bucking the misperceptions that somehow you're lazy or there's something wrong or whatever. It's an injustice that's occurred to millions of Americans. And in Connecticut, it's occurred to thousands and thousands and thousands of people. They're at the base of the unemployment poll. So when we look at the unemployment number in the state and we'd say, okay, it is very high. It's a lot lower than it was 3 years ago, but it is still very high. This is part of the injustice that's occurred in the Great Recession, where we have now segregated all these folks who were working, who are good people, wonderful, wonderful Americans, and they basically have sacrificed themselves for the good of everybody else so that we can transition from a recession to a post-recession period with a thinner, leaner workforce, and this point of advantage having made the shift. They are folks that we need to worry about, we need to think about, because they're entitled to opportunity like everybody else is. They're victims of the Great Recession. They didn't go look for this. They were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And structural change was something that nobody saw coming, including me. I mean, I think that I know it all sometimes, and I've been working on recessions my entire life. I didn't see really the depth of this one coming, so I didn't tell people 4 years ago, you know, you should take any job because, you know, you need to break the cycle of unemployment. That's going to be the greatest barrier to employment. Nobody else did either. So, I mean, I think we need to deal with this group in Connecticut. And by the way, our governor did. Our governor has put up $3.5 million. In fact, he's contracted with the workplace to do what we call Platform to Employment, which is my program for long-term unemployment. We have a rate of success of 89% of moving people from subsidized employment to actually being hired by private employers. And why? Because our approach is dealing with the mind. It's not skills, it's the mind. It's the effects of long-term unemployment on individuals and families that really takes its toll and strips you of your ability to be what you were.
I want to get to some phone calls here. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Jennifer is calling from Wallingford. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you? Good morning.
Good morning. What's in your mind?
I wanted to touch base a little bit about what Deidre was speaking about. As a person who's working in HR and who lives and works in Connecticut, one of the biggest things that I see is intimidation about how to get these jobs, not only with our young people, but also with our older generations that have been displaced, they maybe layoffs or, you know, what have you. And I noticed that there is a huge intimidation with how to obtain these jobs and as well as what the employers are looking for. I see that the employers are looking more towards staffing agencies because they are the ones who are actually training a little bit, you know, the employees in HR, we actually expect that certain people come with basic skills because we know that temp agencies check for those things. So, you know, when you're getting these resumes, you'd be really surprised how savvy certain people are with the internet and on the computer. Hmm. Our young people, they know how to get a video. They know how to, you know, do all these things. But they don't know how to form a resume, have certain social skills. And I think that's something that we really, really are walking away from is those basic social skills, those basic things that our people need just to go out there and get these jobs and also to the expectations of the employers.
It's really interesting getting that HR perspective, Jennifer, because I know you see a lot of that. So I really appreciate your phone call.
Thank you so much.
Let's go to Linda, who's calling from North Stonington. Hello, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm one of the unusual. I'm 60, so I'm from a different group than some of these younger ones coming in. But I was, I didn't go to college, and I sort of worked my way. I didn't know what I wanted to be. I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I decided not to do anything at that point except educate myself in life. And from where I began to where I am, I actually counsel people in alternative holistic practices emotionally. And what I see in my counseling practice is people are feeling like they have become servants to the corporations. And family life suffers, their personal lives, everything suffers because they have to work 24/7. And I think there's a lot of depression, there's a lot of anxiety, and there needs to be balance between real life and work life. And that's what I do very, very well in my life because I've created my own reality through going to school as I saw what I wanted to be when I grew up.
Mm.
So that's my thought.
Linda, it's a really interesting thought. Of course, as we think back to some of the historical tales we told earlier, I'm quite sure that this construct, this idea that the American worker could have some sort of a work-life balance is something that, frankly, only a precious few of us have ever had the opportunity to have, because dating back to the early part of our history, people working very, very long hours in very bad conditions in a lot of cases. But I take your point, and thank you for your phone call. Let's go to Ann in New Haven quickly. A lot of people want to join us. Go ahead, Ann.
Yes, hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yeah, what's up?
So one of the comments that I had was, as the previous caller mentioned, to create your own reality. And I moved to Connecticut a few years ago, and I am a person of color, and I'm really interested in starting a business. And one of the things that I'm finding is that as a diverse business owner with a slightly offbeat plan, it's been a challenge to find support. And I'm seriously considering having to leave Connecticut to find a place that has a bit more opportunities for this.
And that's what we hear over and over again. And where would you go? Because people always talk about the places that they'd go if they have to leave. Where do you go?
Well, I would think about bigger cities, New York, Chicago, L.A., San Francisco, just places where I think there are more possibilities.
You know, I was just having a conversation with somebody about this just the other night, and people say all the time, yeah, there's more work in the cities. There's a lot more to do in New York. But, Anne, the problem is it costs a darn much to live there. It costs a lot to get around. Is it worth it to have a much better employment prospect, but then take on all the other problems that maybe come with trying to find an apartment in San Francisco?
You're absolutely correct. You know, if big cities may not be the only option, you know, considering other maybe college towns where there is a diversity of folks, where a small business could start, you could start a small business without a whole lot of money, and perhaps make your mistakes there and then move to bigger markets.
Well, Anne, first of all, I appreciate your phone call. And secondly, I really hope you stay with us here in Connecticut.
Thank you so much.
And thank you all for your phone calls. We're going to move on in our conversation. I really want to thank our guests for some interesting conversation about work-life history and the present. Amy Trout is curator at the Connecticut River Museum. Thank you so much, Amy, for coming in. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Joe Carbone is CEO of The Workplace in Bridgeport. He talked about his Platform to Employment program. You can find out more at WNPR.org. Joe, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for having me.
When we come back, we're going to take a little bit more of a look at history. The Museum of Historian at Historic New England will be here to talk about a Smithsonian exhibit that's been touring the state. If you want to find out more about the Connecticut at Work Work program from Connecticut Humanities. Just go to our website. It's WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, the reported discovery of Big Bang gravity waves sparked some controversy within the scientific community and caused many to look at the way we report on science. We'll have a conversation about science journalism. We'll talk with Patrick Scahill about what he's doing on his blog, The Beaker. He'll tell us the story of a Connecticut bull and why that bull is considered to be one of the most important farm animals who ever lived. That's our Monday conversation on Labor Day. I hope you can join us. Also join us tonight, this evening, as we record live at Hartford Prince in downtown Hartford. We'll have a panel of artists, musicians, educators for a discussion about the importance of arts education in the lives of our children. Also music from the local band Ellison Jackson. The event is starting at 6 p.m. It's free, open to the public. It's right there on Pratt Street. I hope you can join us tonight in Hartford. Today we're talking about work life in Connecticut, and we want to bring into our conversation Jennifer Putz, who's a museum historian at Historic New England, to talk about a Smithsonian exhibit that's been touring the state. It's called The Way We Worked. It's all part of a big project this year. And Jennifer, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us here on Where We Live.
Thank you for having me.
I'm wondering first if you can tell us where this exhibit is and what people should expect to see.
Sure. The exhibit is currently at the Nathan Hale Homestead in Coventry, Connecticut, and it will be there until September 14th. And then it will move on to the Stanford Museum and Nature Center, followed by the Groton Public Library. And what visitors can expect to see is a lot of wonderful photographs of work life from the mid-19th century through the late 20th century. The exhibition originally opened at the National Archives in Washington at the end of 2005, and it features photographs from the National Archives. Many of them were taken by government agencies to document labor issues, building projects, working conditions, and they really tell the story of workers of every age, every color, every ethnicity, men, women, the young, the old. And it's really a visual feast in terms of the type of labor that just all kinds of things, from agricultural labor to the kind of factory work that the earlier guests were speaking of, to white-collar labor. I would imagine that anybody that visits this exhibition will see someone portrayed in a job they've either done or that a member of their family has done in the past.
I'm wondering, as you look through this exhibit yourself, what are some of the big takeaways from you, maybe things that surprise you about the history of work that maybe we don't think about as we do our own work every day?
Well, I think one of the big takeaways for me has been the complexity of the issue of work. And I think this program today has really gotten at that point very, very well. I hope that one of the biggest takeaways is that people come away having conversations about what they've seen, how what has happened in the past affects the way we work today. One of the things that the exhibition does well is suggest how the workplace has changed. And there's a lot about technology, for example. And, you know, this is in the last segment, a lot of talk about the changing workplace. And as I was listening to the callers and the previous guests, it made me think about how this exhibition shows the technology of work changing, but the work continuing. And so it reminds us that life is going to continue to change. If the textile industry comes back, it's not going to be how it was 150 years ago. And in some cases, that is for the better. So,
of course.
Yeah, so I think that is, I hope, one of the things that people talk about when they leave is how things have changed and how can we continue to change things for the better.
But one of the things that's fascinating to us here, and we did a recent program that I mentioned earlier about vacations and how the American workplace has been set up. We did a program about what our offices look like. And it's a takeaway that is fascinating to me is that the way our offices are designed today at, say, an insurance company, they harken back in many ways to the same factory floor idea. There's a boss kind of in a corner office who's looking out over everyone and making sure that all the workers are doing their jobs, right? There's kind of a hive of activity going on, and someone is overseeing this, making sure that you're not slacking off. You know, maybe back in the day it was, you know, you weren't working hard enough. Today it might be, you know, you're spending too much time on Facebook. But the same idea remains that the workplaces we have today are really informed by the workplaces we set up somewhat haphazardly 200 years ago.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think there is a lot that I think people will see, just as you say, you know, and I hadn't thought of that before, but certainly when you look at some of the photographs that show, you know, what looks like a mile of, you know, textile machines and people stuffing sausages and meatpacking plants. There is always that aspect of surveillance in those kind of settings. And I think, you know, in a lot of workplaces, there still is that kind of cubicle farm that you suggest. But I think more and more people are also, you know, like people were discussing earlier, making their own reality and kind of taking charge of that, their work in a different sort of way. So I think people will see those historical references and how they kind of map onto the current landscape. But I think they'll also see things like, wow, you know, we do that job so differently now.
We do that job differently now. And as you talked about technology, maybe the we is not so many people, right? The technology has taken the jobs away from actual people. And it gets to another fascinating part of what work really means in America today. Jobs, of course, are very important, but work product is very important for companies. So sometimes the work is still done, but it's done by almost no people. It's done by a big computer. That's something that clearly is shown in this history, right? Work has changed. There's just fewer of us doing it.
Right. And one of the things that the exhibition focuses on are jobs that no longer exist. And one that stood out to me was a photograph of a giant telephone switchboard with a whole line of women standing in front of, you know, sitting in front of it, you know, connecting the calls manually, which I'm sure that is not technologically how calls go through today. So it was really interesting how to see, you know, it does, this exhibition does acknowledge that there is a change, that, you know, assembly lines are now staffed by, you know, robots and machinery as opposed to people. And I think, you know, that is something that can cause us to stop and ask, well, what are the things that human beings do much better than machines? Because there are certainly many things that, you know, I think even the smartest computer doesn't have the personal human touch that a human being has. And I think that will come to be incredibly important in a world that is, you know, so dominated by technology. We still want to see ourselves reflected in the world around us.
The Way We Worked exhibition is part of a year-long conversation about the past, present, and future of work life in Connecticut, created by Connecticut Humanities. This exhibition is on display until September 14th at the Nathan Hale Homestead in Coventry. It's been to other locations, and we'll move on from there. You can learn more about it by visiting our website, WNPR.org. Thanks to Jennifer Potts, the museum historian at Historic New England, for taking us on this tour. Thank you, Jennifer.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, and happy Labor Day.
Yes, happy Labor Day to you, too. And this Facebook comment came in from Judy. This Labor Day, thank a worker that overlooked gas station attendant or grocery store clerk who is working so that you can enjoy your Labor Day picnic. Yes, Judy, I think we should all thank a worker, and a very happy Labor Day to you. I hope that you have a chance to relax just a little bit. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. Let me remind you, we'll be doing a little bit more work today, tonight, at Hartford Prince in downtown Hartford. Join us at 6 o'clock. We'll be talking about the importance of arts education. A little bit of music from Ellison Jackson. We'll be taping the program for later broadcast. Hope you can join us tonight in Hartford. This is Where We Live.